And I know the elders are probably a little concerned as it is. You know, they gave me 8 words. You'd say, huh, 8 words, that's not a problem. He can handle that, right? I teach hazmat and OSHA 8 to 10 hours a day. So if I can do that, 8 words is absolutely nothing to me. But the reality of it is the ACLU has made the Ten Commandments something that we've got to tear apart and throw away. You can't possibly have those out there. And then you got groups. Wow, that's awesome. Are we doing a reenactment? If we can get the Mount Sinai thing going. We got groups like Kirk Cameron and Ray Comfort who utilize the Ten Commandments as a witnessing program and the way of the master evangelism. So you kind of got two sides of this. And as a church, unfortunately, in the U.S., we've been really poor about going back and looking at what the Ten Commandments really are and how they fit. And so today, as we work through, and in my job, and I love it, but at the same time, I'm scared to death because I also know I would love to have about 4 hours with you. And that's not going to happen. And even if I did, I know you would all be gone because the reality of it is that this topic requires a little bit of background thought. And so my job this morning is to kind of introduce the background thought and to kind of get you thinking along the lines, what are the Ten Commandments? How do they fit into us as New Testament believers? And so my job this morning is twofold. Number one, I'm going to hopefully inform you and give you a little bit of data so that you have something to work with as the Ten Commandments unfold in the coming weeks. You can come back to this data and you say, oh, yeah, okay, that's making sense. My other job is to say, okay, the Ten Commandments, I'm going to make you a little uncomfortable, and I hope that I do. When I was in seminary, one of the things they taught us is that you always have to know when you stop preaching and start meddling. I'm going to start meddling. That's my job, because if I don't meddle a little bit, then you are comfortable, and you walk out of here just like the Pharisees walked away from Jesus and said, it doesn't matter to me. And the reality of it is if the Word of God does not change your life, why are we here? And the reality of it is that we worship a great God, and we want to understand what He gave us and how He gave it to us. And so as we look at the Ten Commandments, we have to, first of all, think, and I'm going to, here's your first brain buster, okay? Do you know the Ten Commandments are not actually the Ten Commandments? Really? Yeah. In Hebrew, it is not the Ten Commandments, it's the Ten Words. There's no such thing as the Ten Commandments. You say, well, oh my, you've blown apart my whole world. I hope not. I hope that you'll understand that what that does, and if you want to use an official term here, and this will make you sound smarter amongst friends, neighbors, countrymen, Decalogue, okay? Decalogue from the Greek, deca, 10, logos, word, there are the 10 words. So in order to be accurate, we're going to say the Decalogue, the 10 words, rather than the 10 commandments, and now we appear smarter and people will listen. Oh, well, I tried to sell that. Anyway, as we look at the Ten Commandments, one of the issues we have, and as we work through them, one of the things we have to consider is that as we look at these, how do they relate to me as a New Testament believer? Because, you know, we see in Romans that we are not under the law, and the law has no part for us, yet the Ten Commandments are part of the law. You say, well, those are all good instruction. You're absolutely right. They are good instruction. So, if the Ten Commandments we're not under, then why do we try and keep the Ten Commandments, or why do we feel like we need to keep them when there's other parts of the commandments that we ignore? Kosher laws. Anybody have bacon this morning? I know you did, Kristen. Kosher law, oh my, you've offended. No, why don't we keep those? And those are good questions. Those are valid questions, right? But even within the Ten themselves, you know, we look at the Ten Commandments and, you know, we go down through them, okay? You're not to have any other gods. You're not going to build an idol. You'll keep the Sabbath day. Wait a minute. What day is the Sabbath day? And don't say Sunday. Why don't we keep the Sabbath day? Because we're not under the law. Well, wait a minute. But then why did I keep the first one? Valid questions, right? And so as we work through this morning, and what I want you to see and understand that the covenant of God was given within a cultural parameter. And that cultural parameter helps us understand why the covenant was given and how it works. And the beauty of it is when we come to the new covenant, us, how does this relate to that? In other words, there's got to be a relationship. How do they fit together? And it's amazing because as you look at the Ten Commandments, you see that part of them is included in all the commandments of the law. And they regulate every portion of life. They tell you what to eat, who to talk to, how to grow your crops, how to dress, how to use the bathroom. Did you realize that in the law, they tell you that using an outhouse is about right? Indoor plumbing, that's a no-no. I'm not ready to go back to that. I love camping, don't get me wrong, but I'm not going back to that. So the reality of it is this morning is what we're going to do is we're going to look at the context of the covenant first. Actually, we're going to look at the context of the commandment, which is the covenant. Then we're going to look at the context, not of the commandment itself, but we're going to look at covenant, both old and new. Then what we're going to look at is the content of the commandment, the eight words for the first commandment. And then ultimately, we're going to get to the consequence of the commandment. In other words, it doesn't do us any good to understand all this data if we don't do something with it. So tomorrow morning, I expect that all of us are going to be able to do something with the data that we're going to work on this morning. So if you would, turn with me to Exodus chapter 19. We've got to get this started in Exodus 19. Now, you'll forgive me if I refer back to my notes here and then. The reality of it is that I am so excited about this, and the data that's involved in this is so humongous. Literally, I could talk to you for hours about this. And most of you are going, oh, I'm good thing he has notes. You should be. I stay to my notes. If I stay to my notes, you are safe. If I do not, we're all in danger. And my wife always tells me I have to bring notes. She ensures that I bring them. So Exodus chapter 19, we need to look at the cultural format that this was put into. Okay. Now, the first thing we have to understand is that as God opens up the word here and we see what's going on, this is nothing new to these people. Okay? This is all new to us. We don't understand ancient Near Eastern covenant. Years ago, that was one of my areas of specialty, looking at covenants and looking at them. And we'll talk more about this later, but I was planning on attending University of Chicago and majoring in Hittite so that I could study more about covenants in the original languages. That didn't happen, but all that to say, we have to understand the cultural form. This cultural form, covenant, was an official way in the ancient Near East to demonstrate relationship. If we're going to have a relationship, an official relationship, we will have to establish a covenant. And in the ancient Near East, that covenant was built upon certain specific parameters. In other words, this happened generally all the time and generally in this order. Okay, now there was a little mix and match here and there, but generally speaking, if you were starting a covenant, the first thing you would do is you would have two parties that needed to make a covenant for a reason, specifically because either they were warring factions, they weren't getting along as neighbors. There's a myriad of different reasons to have a covenant, but most of them worked out the same way. When you establish a covenant, the first thing you had to do is set up what they call the historical prologue. What is that? Historical prologue basically is, why do we need this covenant? Side A says that this is their issue. Side B says that this is their issue. And when we come together, we're going to have to figure out why we're having an issue and why we want to come together in relationship. Now, the type that we see here in the ancient Near East is what they would call a suzerain-vassal treaty. Suzerain-vassal basically means king and not king. A primary king would say, you know what, I'm having problems with this country over here. I want to solve the issues. We're warring all the time. I'm actually the top king in the land. I'm going to dictate to you what we need to do. So we're going to establish a covenant. On such and such a date, you know, we fought, and such a date we fought. That's over. I'm going to stop fighting as long as you give me on such and such a date certain things. And so they set down a relationship and said, this is going to be our new relationship. This is the type of covenant that we see here in Exodus 19. First thing is you state the historical prologue. The second thing that you do is you state the stipulations. I'm going to do such and such, you're going to do such and such. And so those stipulations would go back and forth. Normally, if you have a suzerain vassal, whoever the suzerain is dictates the stipulations. In other words, the vassal doesn't get to say, well, this is what I want. It really doesn't go that way. It's, I'm the king, I'll tell you what the stipulations are. You'll do this, I'll do this. And generally, in the ancient Near East, what they would say is they build a treaty that would help the lesser. And in other words, I'd say, you know what, I'm going to protect you if, as long as you give me, you know, 10,000 cores of wheat every year and 15 tares of gold every year, then I will make sure that nobody bugs you, I'll take care of you. And that's kind of how it worked. Then they went to the next stage, which is called the cursings and blessings. Cursings and blessings, basically what they said is they didn't have a judge system in the ancient Near East. So you can't just take it to court when you have a problem. So the curses and blessings, what they would do is in the ancient Near East, they'd say, we're going to call upon the gods of blah, 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 and they're going to officiate over this covenant. If you break the covenant, in other words, you don't keep the stipulations, then may the fleas of 1,000 camels infest your armpits type mentality. Okay? That was what they would do. And, you know, and they'd say, you know, may all the children, you know, of your offspring be ugly children and forever in eternity. And those are the kind of things that they would say because they would appeal to the different gods. And of course, we don't have those exact things here, but we'll talk about how we see that. And then the last thing they would do is they would secure a place for the document. In other words, we've written this out. We want to make sure everybody knows and understands it. Now we're going to have a place. And normally they would find a God's temple, and they would put the document there. One copy would be for them to read, and the other copy would be for the king to read, and they would keep those copies so that everybody knows what the stipulations are and what the issues are. And then what they would do is they would have a sacrifice. They would kill the animal. They would drain its blood. The blood would be used as a sacred omen, and then they would take the flesh, and then they would eat the flesh together in a meal to show that they have now established covenant. That's the ancient Near East. Okay? Let's look at Exodus 19. And we're going to see that God uses this in Exodus 19 to formulate the Mosaic Covenant. So the Mosaic Covenant, and I'm going to apologize, this is going to seem like 100 miles an hour, and it is, only because we have to get to the practical part. What am I going to do with this? But it's going to seem like 100 miles an hour, but I want you to see these connections, okay? Exodus 19, they've stopped at Mount Sinai. And Moses goes up the mountain, and Moses becomes the intermediary because Moses goes up the mountain, he talks to God, he comes back down, he talks to the people. And the people go, well, what about this? And so he goes back up to God, and then he comes back down. And if you read Exodus 19, what you find is there's this, he goes up the mountain, he comes back down the mountain, he goes up the mountain, he comes back down the mountain. What's the purpose? The purpose is that God is relaying his information to the people via Moses. Why is that? Well, good question. But let's look in verse 3 to see how this thing gets started. Moses goes up to God. The Lord called him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the sons of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. See what he's doing here? He's talking about the historical prologue. This is beginning that stage where in a covenant situation you say, what's our history? Well, the history is, I saved you from bondage. I brought you here. Now we're going to have a covenant. Notice what he promises. God says to them, what? Now then, if you will indeed obey my voice, keep my covenant, you will be my own possession among all the peoples, for all the earth is mine. Here's number one. He says, you will be my segula. Yeah, that's a fancy word. That's a nice Hebrew word. Bring it on your friends. Use that 3 times this week. Segula. Segula is a personal property that the king had beside his normal riches. In other words, I have my big throne room, I have all my riches, this is all mine, quote, as a nation. But I have a special little treasure trove back here that's mine. It's only used 8 times in all the Old Testament, only twice that doesn't refer to Israel. One of them is in 1 Chronicles 29:3. David says, I have brought all this wealth together to build the temple. And he says, oh, by the way, I have a little stash, a segula, back here that I'm going to give of my own to make sure that temple gets built. And so we understand the definition is what God is saying is, you, Israel, as a nation, will be my special little property as owner and king over all the earth. I want that to be you. And look at the next verse. He says that you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Now, what we need to see here, first of all, is that this covenant is established so that Israel will be a special possession of God, and they will be a holy nation, a kingdom of priests. What's the point? What does a priest do? A priest is an intermediary, what, between God and man. So as a nation, their job is to intermediate between all the other nations and God. This covenant is not salvific. In other words, it wasn't designed to save people. That's not the point. The point of this was to make Israel a special nation that demonstrates for the world what does holiness look like and what's coming. You're going to tell us about what's coming. That Messiah who's coming, you're going to tell us about that. That's your job. What's fascinating here is if you turn to 1 Peter 2, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time this morning, 1 Peter 2:9, Peter says to us as New Testament believers, he says that you are a holy people, and he says, he takes the words and he twists them. He doesn't say you're a kingdom of priests. He says you are a royal priesthood. You say, what's the difference? Huge difference. Relationship. They are a kingdom, a nation of priests. We, as New Testament believers, are royal priests. What does that mean? We're related to the king, but we still have the functioning of a priesthood. Dramatically different. Why? Because even in this room, we have different nations. It all comes together, right? It's not bound by national ties. It's bound by our relationship to the king. So God says, first of all, here's a historical prologue. That's to get you started. But notice next in the next verse. So Moses came, he calls the elders of the people, and he sets before them all the words, and just as the Lord commanded. And all the people together say, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. Why? They don't really have a choice, right? No, God, I think that we're going to do it this way. What do you think? It doesn't work that way. And it doesn't work that way at all. In fact, as you go through this, one of the things you're going to notice is as we go through, they say, okay, now let's get you prepared. We're going to go through the ceremony. We have to get through that. So Moses goes up, Moses comes down, Moses goes up, Moses comes down. Verse 14, Moses went down from the mountain, gets the people consecrated, and when they've washed their garments, don't go up the mountain, do not be near a woman. So it came about on the third day when it was morning, there was thunder, there was lightning flashes, there's a thick cloud, there's the sound of a trumpet, and all the camp is standing there and they're trembling. In other words, this God is scary. This king is more powerful than anything that we were in the greatest nation on earth, Egypt, 3 months ago. And this thing is scarier than that. And so what he does then is he gets ready to tell the Ten Commandments, and what we see in the end of this chapter is that Moses starts now to recount what God is telling him. Okay? All the people are waiting at the mountain, and God in chapter 20 now starts to tell the people and Moses what this covenant is going to entail, the stipulations. In other words, what are you going to do? So he starts telling them the stipulations. The stipulations are started with the 10 words. Okay? Now, notice verse 18. The 10 words end. As they end, all the people perceive the thunder and the lightning and the flashes and the sound. As they stood at a distance, what do they say? They said to Moses, speak to us yourself, and we will listen, but let not God speak to us or we will die. In other words, we're scared to death. We're not doing this. Moses, you go up there, figure it out, and you come tell us. I remember when I was at camp, my dad, he always did this. We had three or four of us, all the boys, usually me, Scott. We had a friend that came over to camp all the time, and occasionally Mike and Dave, but most of it was us three. And he'd inevitably spell out this job that we were to do. You're to do this and this and this and this. And we go, and then we go, okay. And we walk away and we go, did you understand? No, did you? No, I really don't know what he said. Well, let's do this. And we inevitably work for 3 to 4 hours. And then we come back. He goes, didn't you listen to me? And then he explained the whole thing over again. And, of course, you know, we're looking around. And, of course, we weren't listening. And you end up doing the job again. That's the Israelites. Okay? They are 16-year-old boys when Dad's talking to them. Yeah, I'm listening. No, they're not. In fact, they're scared to death, but they don't really listen because what happens? in the first commandment. You will have no other gods before me. What do they do while Moses is gone? I make another god. Were you listening? No. But the point of it here is that we've found that the stipulations start, but now the stipulations end. Why? Because they're scared to death. And so Moses goes back up the mountain, and God gives all the rest of these stipulations to him. So we can't think of the 10 words as the covenant. They're not. They're the start of the covenant. They're the part that they actually heard. All the rest of it, from Exodus 21, 22, 23, Exodus 25, through the end of the book, and all of Leviticus basically is what Moses calls the Book of the Covenant, and Moses writes all this down and brings it down to the people. And so what we see here is that these covenant stipulations are given to Moses, and Moses brings them back. Now, there's a little pause in the text. We've got to skip to chapter 24, move to chapter 24. As we move to chapter 24, what we realize is that now, these stipulations, once they're given, we've got to solidify these stipulations. So Moses has them. And so now in verse 24, that picks up, after these are written down, Moses is now coming back down the mountain. Verse 3, he came, related all the words of the people, all the words of the Lord to the people, and they answered in one voice, all the words which the Lord has spoken we will do. So in other words, this is now confirmed. And so Moses wrote all these words down. He arose early in the morning and he built an altar. And he had 12 pillars. And he sent young men of the sons of Israel, and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls as peace offerings. And Moses took half of the blood, he put it in basins, half he sprinkled on the altar, half he sprinkled on the Book of the Covenant. Why? What's the Book of the Covenant? Representative of God. In other words, we're sprinkling both. We're demonstrating that God is a part of this. And then Moses, verse 9, went up with Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, the 70 of the elders of Israel. They saw the God of Israel, and under his feet there appeared to be pavement of sapphire as clear as the sky. Yet he did not stretch out his hand against the nobles of Israel. They saw God, and they ate, and they drank. Here's the covenant confirmation. Here they come, they take that sacrifice stuff, and they have a meal in front of God, demonstrating this covenant solidification. And in fact, the only thing that's left is verse 12. The Lord said, come up to me on the mountain, remain there, and I will give you what? The stone tablets with the law, and I love this, the law and the commandment. Not commandments, the law and the commandment. In other words, it's all one big whole. You can't separate it. You don't get to pick and choose. What does James tell us? If you offend in one, you what? You offend in all, right? So the point of this is that you can't do both. So we see this covenant format followed to the T. So we can't think of the Ten Commandments as Ten Commandments that we can section off. They are part of the greater whole. But we are new covenant believers. We are not old covenant believers. So what does this matter to us? And as you look at these tablets, you know, one of the things that you think in your mind, and in the past we used to do this, we take, well, there's two tablets because they wrote, you know, five on one, five on the other, right? No, they were written front and back. And there were probably two separate tablets. One is God's, one's theirs. Why? Because that was what you demonstrated, that each of you had a copy so that you knew what the law was. Now, in the ancient Near East, this thing stayed intact as long as the suzerain does, right? If you lose your power or lose your life, the covenant kind of goes away. Well, they've just made a covenant with what? The eternal, omniscient, omnipotent God. What's the likelihood this is going away? It's not. Until God decides that he's going to create a new covenant. That's why all this matters. So why does this matter? The purpose of the covenant, number one, not salvific. Second, the Ten Commandments are a symbol for all the rest. Number three, and this is most important, the Mosaic Covenant was designed so that a group of people could demonstrate what holiness looks like. What does it not do? It doesn't change the heart. the new covenant starts at the heart. And as we alluded to this morning when we were considering the elements, that blood is that sanctifying blood we take inside us. We get cleaned from the inside out. So as new believers in the new covenant, we are to be holy. Why? Because God has cleansed us from the heart. We get a change of heart. We get the Spirit to help that. So these 10 words, and I find this fascinating, are reduplicated, so to speak, in the New Testament. And I wish I had time this morning, and I really don't. But I want you to see, when Jesus says, a new commandment, singular, I give to you, what is that? You love one another, what? Even as I have loved you. In other words, your commandment under your covenant, the new covenant, your overall riding commandment. You know, wait a minute, overall riding commandment. Is that the first commandment? No. What's the overall riding commandment of the Old Testament? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. That's not even in the 10, right? But it is the overriding commandment. Jesus told us so. So the overriding commandment of the new covenant is, all I have to do is love everybody exactly the way God does. Got that under control? We say, well, wait a minute, can you explain that a little bit? Actually, we can. The 10 commandments, right, kind of explain how do you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. 10 commandments tell us to do that. Number one, you've got to have a God that you know and understand. Number two, you have to understand who that God is and who people are and how you relate to those people. But notice, almost all those are behaviorally oriented. Okay? New covenant. Okay, love the Lord your God. Okay, I understand that. New covenant, now I have to love each one of you as God's loved you. And now here's my marching orders. Matthew 28, what do? I make disciples, the only verb there, imperative verb. I make disciples by what? Going, baptizing, and here's the kicker, teaching them to observe everything I've commanded you. You got that under control? As long as every one of you here has been baptized and is doing everything that Jesus told us, we're good. Jesus, the job is done. Come on back. Right? Till then, we still have a little bit of work to do. So the point of this new covenant is a little bit different than the old covenant because the working out from the inside has to demonstrate itself in actual holiness, whereas the old one, the holiness is regulated. And so when we come to this, and that's how the New Testament epistles kind of spell all that out. The Old Testament was to foster holiness in my behavior. The New Testament is to change me from the inside out and create in me a new person who will live out the Word of God via the Spirit of God. Now, that brings us to the actual commandment. Let's take a look at it. Okay? The actual commandment we've got to look at. Number one, chapter 20. God spoke these words saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt and out of the house of slavery. In other words, he's restating a historical prologue here. Just so you remember, you owe me, right? Commandment number one, you shall have no other gods before me. There's three things we want to look at. Number one, the prequel. Number two, the prohibition. Number three, the perception. Prequel, God deserves their obedience because he is a king and he is a vassal. The prohibition. Okay. Second thing, you shall have no other gods before me. The Hebrew here is a lot of people go, oh, this is accented. It's not. It's just a general prohibition. It just says, you will not have any gods before me. Now, here's the problem. As we break it down, one of the things you have to see is no other gods, literally, against my face. You say, well, that's kind of an odd way of putting it. It is. But it basically means this, that you will have no other so-called gods even in my presence where I can see them. Now, in the ancient Near East, that's pretty easy to do, right? You know, you got to remember, they would build a temple and then they put a little god idol here and a god idol here. And so it's like, well, I don't have any other gods. You know, you remember the forefathers, the patriarchs, they had gods. They kept the little, you know, gods in their tents and around. And we remember even the story of Jacob coming back to meet Esau, and they're looking for the little idols, and it's like, where are they? And Rachel's sitting on them. And so we know that they have those, and what God is saying is those are a no-no now. I am your special God only. Now, think to yourselves, okay, what does that mean for me? We're coming to that. Okay, the last thing we have to look at is chapter 20, verse 23. When the people cut them off, or cut off the Lord and say, you know, we're scared, we want Moses to handle this. So Moses goes back up, and God starts to speak to Moses again. And it's interesting, because when he does this, this is what they call, in literature, they call it an incipit. An incipit means that we start over again, and we use the beginning of a phrase we already know to show that the whole thing is done again. And so what does he say? He says in verse 23, you shall make no other gods besides me. And literally, in Hebrew, he changes the wording. And what he says here is, you shall make no other gods with me. In other words, there should be nothing else that falls into the category of God that stands anywhere around me. And actually, the King James is the only one who translates this properly. And when I say properly, what I mean is following the Hebrew grammar. And this is a problem we constantly have in translation. When you come from one language to another, it never goes across perfect. So the King James actually writes in bad English in order to make the Hebrew look good. And literally, what it says is this: you will not make with me gods of silver, chiasm, gods of gold you shall make for yourself. So in other words, what he's saying here is that you won't have in my presence anything that's considered God. Now, you remember, Elohim is a term that can refer to judges, it can refer to people in authority, it can refer to angels. So there are several things that this can refer to. And so what he says is, you're not going to have any of those in my presence. Okay? Consequences. Consequences of this commandment. Pretty simple, right? We should all feel pretty comfortable. Do any of you have an idol at home that you're bowing down to? Whew, man, we're good, right? Let's go home. You see, in the ancient Near East and under the Mosaic Covenant, they could. Why? Because it's based on behavior. So, Captain Obvious, if you don't have one at home and you're not going to visit one, you're pretty much there. And you say, wait a minute. Is it possible? It's still possible. Okay? Have you heard this? Or have you seen this little bumper sticker? It says coexist. Have you seen it? What does that mean? We're all the same. It's okay. No, we're not. There is one God only. And guess what? He doesn't take kindly to someone else being called God that is not. So we have to understand that God is not Allah with a different name. God is not Buddha with a different name. God is not the trees and the grass and the flowers. He's not. He is revealed in Scripture as who He is. And so that is the form of breaking the first commandment. But let's move to the New Testament now. Wait a minute. It's not about the action in the New Testament. It's about the heart. And this is where it gets scary. And I hope that I meddle a little bit here. But you got to remember that gods are a lot of different things, are they not? Ever make yourself God? You go, wow, absolutely not. Really? Because I do. Because I want what I want. Guess what that's called? God. How do I spend my time? Does God dictate that, or do I? How do I spend my money? Do I dictate that? Yes, you do. Under the new covenant, you dictate your money as a what? Steward of God. In other words, you are His steward, and someday you give an account for all of God's money you've been spending. It's all His. And someday, how you bought Starbucks coffee versus the discount coffee will be in an account. Well, maybe not. Maybe not. But the reality of it is there, is that everything that I do is His. And so if I make myself God, I run into the danger of breaking the first commandment. Not in the Mosaic Covenant. You got to understand, we are not under the Mosaic Covenant. Actually, it's worse, because we are under the New Covenant, which says anything in the Mosaic Covenant that is dictated outside the realm of culture is binding in the heart, not just the action. In other words, what does Jesus tell us? You shall not, what? Commit adultery. But if you do it up here, God says you're still liable. So if I make something else God up here, you're still liable. here's the one that kicks me, and I have to tell you a little story with this. Sometimes we make others God. 26 years ago, my daughter was about to be born. I was working at a hospital. One of the elders of our church took over at the hospital as the HR guy. Cindy and I were just getting ready to have children at the time, and so we went in. The hospital was supposed to cover us 100% for insurance. This new HR guy, who was an elder of our church, forgot to file it. And we thought, well, it'll be all right. Pre-existing condition, no big deal. You know, it's pretty simple. Not a problem. Well, come to find out, it was a big deal. Cindy was in and out of the hospital, preterm labor from about 5 months till the end. She was in and out of the hospital 5 or 6 times. Megan was born premature, so we had all the bills. So thousands and thousands of dollars got added to our bill. It's like, well, wait a minute, we can't sue. We're putting out of a job a man that is an elder and worthy of respect within our community. So we'll just start paying it. And so we started paying the bill. But in my heart, for years and years, I thought, you know what? Had that guy done his job, I'd be on the mission field like I wanted to do. And the reality is, just a couple years ago, we went back and visited that same church. My son, ironically, is preaching there. And so we go to hear him preach. And we walk down the hall, and here I run into this man that so many years ago had made that mistake. And I saw him, and it's like, well, he's blind. He can't see. He doesn't recognize me. He shakes my hand, and he doesn't recognize who I am at all. And I said, well, you know, the last time I was here, you were the head of the entire hospital HR department. He goes, yeah. He said, I only did that for about a year. I said, really? He said, yeah, I had a severe stroke just after that. I was blinded, I was crippled, and basically I haven't worked since. In my heart, I pointed to him and thought, that's the God that changed my life. It wasn't. It was the God of heaven who said, I will use who I use, and thee will be a tool for me to do something different. And as much as I would have liked to have been on the mission field 26 years ago, it didn't happen because there is a God in heaven who decided that that was not his plan. Be careful. The God that we control is not a tame God. He decides what is best for all. And I have had opportunities in this country and abroad, things that I could have never dreamed of, even though I've been stuck here for years and years and years. And they say, stuck here? What do you mean? My heart's intent was to finish a PhD and teach in Australia. That was my intent. It never happened. And yet, God, through us, have done a lot of things, and our son is now ready to go into the pastorate. You say, God, was that your plan? Maybe. But don't take away from God the fact that he is God. It's not your job. So as we contemplate these things this morning, just understand that he is a God who is worthy of our praise. He's also a God who's called us to worship him alone. Don't put other people in his place. Don't put yourself in his place. Understand that he deserves that love, that respect, that honor. Father, we're thankful for your word. There's so much here that we haven't touched on, and yet we also understand, Father, that you are, through your Spirit, driving it home to your people, because each one here, if they've made a commitment to you, has the Spirit dwelling within, and that Spirit will teach us what we need to know about your word. We just thank you so much for who you are. May this morning please you, because as we leave, we are again refreshed in knowing that we serve a great God who is soon coming, and that as we stand before him when he comes, we want to be found faithful and hear those words, well done, good and faithful servant. May it be so. We ask in your son's name. Amen. Thank you.